Welcome to Beyond the Launch, where we engage with experienced entrepreneurs and business leaders to get a look into their lives and entrepreneurial journeys. I'm Michael Goldberg, Executive Director of the Veal Institute for Entrepreneurship at Case Western Reserve University. Thanks for making the time. We hope you enjoy the conversation.
It's a great pleasure to introduce an old friend to our speaker series, Chris Young. We met as undergrads at Princeton and fellow Clevelanders. Chris, as he'll sort of share his career journey, grew up here in Cleveland Heights, where I sit right now, and was part of our Cleveland sports. I had to put my Gay Day in the background. You know, we both grew up in the time of baseball and football at Cleveland Municipal Stadium, so we spent time together at Princeton. And actually, we overlapped, as we did with Todd Fetterman, who's on the call from North Coast Ventures at America Online. And I've gotten to keep up with Chris's career journey, mostly via social media and LinkedIn, and seeing all the great things that he's doing. And we recently connected a few weeks ago, and he was nice enough to join us for our speaker series today. So Chris, it's great to see you again, and thank you for doing this.
Thanks for having me.
And our student moderator today is actually our second two-time moderator. Sasong actually kicked off our speaker series moderating a session with Mike Fisher, who's the CTO of Etsy, way back when we used to get together in person. So that was at ThinkBox before the pandemic, and Sasong's a recent graduate of Case and now working at Google. And maybe you could say a few words about what you're up to now. And it's great to connect with Sasong. I know graduation wasn't what anyone thought it was going to be in May, but congratulations to you and Emily and two Emilys that are both recent grads. I know, again, this spring was a bit disrupted, but Sasong, I'll turn it over to you. The way we do these sessions for those that are new is Sasong is going to sort of run the show, kind of be in conversation with Chris. If anybody wants to ask a question, just put a note in the chat to Sasong, and you can unmute yourself and ask it directly of Chris. If you're on LinkedIn Live, just put it in the comment, and then Doug and Elizabeth and I will be monitoring, and we'll make sure we get it in. So with that, over to you, Sasong.
Thanks. And also, thanks again for having me here for the second time. It's an honor to be back in moderating. But yes, so I graduated from Case Western in May, and I started in a rotational sales program at Google also in May. So I've just been acting as an account manager in healthcare, which has been fun. But today we're here to talk with Chris Young about his experiences. And today I just kind of wanted to go over like your career path, your leadership lessons learned, and also kind of address some of the kind of recent cybersecurity issues we've been seeing. But as Michael said, floor is totally open if other people have questions, we can kind of jump in. But as my first question, I was kind of curious if you could just talk us through your career journey. So like from your bio, we see you got your MBA at Harvard, undergrad at Princeton, moved to Intel, and then CEO, and then now serving on these boards. But I was wondering if you could just take us behind the scenes. Like, what was your kind of thoughts throughout this entire journey, and how have you kind of ended up where you are today?
Well, I think number one, thank you all for having me. It's always fun to talk about the journey. But, you know, it's interesting. You know, no one ever, you know, most people you'll talk to, and this includes me, would tell you that almost never can you exactly plan out your journey. In fact, one of the best pieces of advice I got, you know, from a friend of mine many, many years ago, is he said, you know, don't think of your career as a linear progression where everything just goes up and to the right. It usually doesn't work that way. It's more like a tapestry where you put pieces in place, and only if you step back from it can you see what the pattern actually is supposed to reveal. And obviously that's a very abstract way of thinking about it, but I think it's very instructive, because, you know, certainly when you spend most of your life, you know, in school and such, you know, going from grade to grade to grade, and it's about, you know, your grades and your tests. And but once you get out into the career world, you find, you know, you try some things work, some things don't work. You know, and I've had an interesting journey. You know, went through my schooling, you know, really great undergrad opportunity at Princeton, which was for me very transformational in terms of kind of what I thought was available to me from a career perspective. You know, after school, I did management consulting for just a few years. But then actually decided to go be an entrepreneur. And I joined with a few guys. We started a security company called Cyvalence. It was in the Washington, D.C. area. Kind of rode it up in the late 90s with the market, rode it down in 2000 when everything really blew up. And decided at that point to go back to business school. From there, made my way to AOL, as Mike and I were talking about a little bit earlier. And then, you know, went to a number of different companies along the way. I was at RSA Security at one point. We got purchased by EMC. And then most recently, I was at Intel, and we spun McAfee out, and I had the opportunity to run McAfee as the CEO. You know, when I started, so, you know, what's interesting, one thing that's interesting about my career is I started out in cybersecurity. When I started in cybersecurity, no one even called it cybersecurity. It was InfoSec or ITSec. I'm probably one of the few people that you will meet that's actually been in that space for a long period of time, and has kind of seen it go through a lot of different iterations, and now become something that's frankly quite mainstream. You know, you almost can't be in the technology space today without paying, either offering something that's a security solution or certainly consuming a tremendous amount of security capability as part of whatever offer you're bringing to market. So it's been, you know, the way I would say it is that, you know, I didn't plan necessarily on all the different moves that would happen or that I would make. You know, in most cases, it was, you know, whatever I did next was about learning more, growing, trying to stretch myself with the long-term vision that, you know, I'd be able to run something one day. And that I've had the opportunity to do that. And it's been a lot of fun. Now I'm kind of thinking about what I might do next.
That's awesome. Thank you for sharing your story. And before we jump more into like questions about leadership, I was just kind of curious, in this kind of context of thinking about your unplanned moves and being in that environment where you're perpetually seeking growth, with a lot of the people on this call being recent graduates or students who are kind of trying to figure out what comes next in terms of their career path, do you have any advice to specifically speak to that situation?
I'd say, number one, it's okay to be unsure about what's next. In fact, if you're just coming out of undergrad or business school, I would frankly be a bit concerned if you thought you had it all figured out, because chances are you don't. Like, the world changes, and certainly in the world that you and I are in, technology, the cycle times and the change, it changes so quickly. You almost can't plan out something that's gonna, you know, sort of go from step to step to step, because, you know, you don't know what companies are gonna be the winners, what companies are gonna be the losers, because the world is moving so quickly, particularly in our business. And frankly, I think we've seen this year in particular, the world being quite different across every industry, and what you might have considered to be the winners and losers coming into the year 2020 has certainly turned out to be a quite different year than we all would have expected. And it's transforming so many industries, not just technology. So it's okay to be unsure. One thing I always tell people, as I mentioned earlier, I think particularly when you're in the start of your career, and I think this is true throughout much of it, seek to learn and grow. It's really important. The choices you make about what companies to work for, what roles to accept, I just think early on it's critical that one of your main criteria, not all of it, but one of your main criteria has to be, what growth opportunity does this afford me? Am I going to learn something that I didn't understand before? Am I going to build upon a skill set that I'm already good at? Is it going to stretch me in ways that I haven't been stretched to date? I just think that's such a critical element of any decision you would make around a job or what to do in your career, or importantly, who you would go work with in a given company as you make those kinds of decisions on what's next. Obviously, you know, things like location are a factor, compensation is always a factor, but I think growth development is important. And I think it's also important to kind of understand how that's going to help build upon kind of your longer term aspirations, you know, what you want to do over the long run. Some people want to be CEOs, a lot of business school types, And I went to Harvard Business School. Everybody at Harvard Business School, to some degree, they either kind of want to go into finance and be a very wealthy investor or become a CEO or something like that. But over time, you start to learn there's a lot of different career paths. And it's good to kind of know broadly where you want to go. But it's important, I think, also not to anchor yourself too much. Be open to some things that might be different. Be open to new experiences, because you will find that along the way, certain opportunities will present themselves that might not have been obvious going in, but ultimately become the right opportunities in retrospect.
That's a great point. And then in the spirit of like figuring out different paths to go, I feel like having an entrepreneurial spirit is important regardless of if you are day one starting your own venture or, you know, leading a company. And how do you feel like you've maintained that spirit throughout your journey and like kept that kind of top of mind?
You know, the difference between being an entrepreneur and working, you know, being a big company CEO or executive, it comes down to a few things. And one of them, I will tell you, I rarely recommend business books, but, you know, Ben Horowitz, who's an investor, Andreessen Horowitz, you know, he wrote this book called The Hard Thing About Hard Things. It's a good read. I actually recommend it. But one of the things he points out in the book, which was always something that stuck with me, is that when you're an entrepreneur or you work in a small company, you know, you have to play offense with your time. You know, you got to go get the meeting. You got to go call on a customer because people aren't clamoring for your time. Whereas in bigger companies, you spend a lot of time playing defense with your time. You know, what meeting am I going to be in? Am I going to go here? Am I going to go there? And that's more true as you move up the ladder in big companies too, where your calendar starts to become something that you manage versus saying, I'm going to go do this. I'm going to do that. I'm going to proactively make things happen. And I do think that that's an interesting juxtaposition between kind of being an entrepreneur and being a bigger company executive, is that entrepreneurs have to go out and get it. They have to make something happen. They have to get on people's schedule. They have to be purposeful about what they do. Whereas, you know, and I think this is something that if you're in a big company, if you can maintain that point of view, whereas yes, you do have to be in certain meetings, you do have to do certain things as part of your job, but if you can keep a portion of your thinking and your time reserved for that offensive mentality where you say, you know, my agenda is to do these three things, and I'm going to make sure that I go proactively attack those opportunities, those objectives. That's one way to kind of maintain a bit of what I'll consider to be an entrepreneurial spirit as part of working at a bigger organization. I think that's incredibly important. I think it's also another element that I would share here is entrepreneurs are you know, sort of, they're sort of rooted in the art of the possible. You know, they're not necessarily focused on what's, you know, what other people think is probable or important. They're sort of thinking about, you know, what the world could or should look like down the line, either for their company, for their product, for their customers. And again, when you're in a bigger organization, sometimes it's easy to kind of just go along with the momentum that you've got in your business. But again, you know, I think if you look at some of the bigger companies in the world today, you know, what makes them unique? Think about them. Amazon, Microsoft, Google, like those are companies where the leadership has, you know, they haven't been complacent with the status quo. They've been thinking, you know, what's transformational? What's going to really change things? And Amazon has been great about, you know, Jeff Bezos with the day one thinking, like we're always going to act like it's day one. Everything's new. Everything we did last year doesn't matter anymore. I love that way of thinking. Look at Microsoft, right? They're, you know, talking about buying TikTok and, you know, like, totally different than you would expect, but that may or may not work. It doesn't matter. It's the thinking, it's the pushing of the envelope that I think is emblematic of entrepreneurial thinking. But you're actually starting to see how it works in some of the bigger companies that are out there. And I think that's what's going to drive them for, you know, kind of more sustained success over the long run.
It is super important to maintain that momentum and be intentional about the way you're going about strategy. So now I'm a bit curious about kind of what's your philosophy in terms of, you can't do these things alone, right? You have to have a team. What's your philosophy on building business relationships and kind of being a leadership and having people kind of follow this vision that you have?
Well, I think team is incredibly important no matter where you are in your career. you know, what teams you're a part of as you become a leader in an organization, what teams you build. You know, as a CEO, one piece of advice I've constantly given to my senior leaders is, you know, if you think about it, one of the very few things you actually control directly every single day is who's on your team. You get to make that decision, right? Because you hire those people. If they don't work out, you're in a position to let those people go and replace them with other people. And I think that's super important because, you know, you can't always control if a customer is going to pick you or not pick you versus a competitor. You can't always control if you're going to get an investment. You can't always control, you know, if you're going to have a problem that was unknown is going to arise. But you do control your team. And you also, as someone who's going to be on a team, you get to pick. You know, what teams do I want to be on? I mean, particularly, I think, in certain industries, and this isn't always true, but for people with their MBAs and people who work in, you know, the kinds of industries that I think many of you will go into, you know, you're not necessarily working for the paycheck you're going to get next week. Like, I grew up in a household where my parents worked for their paycheck every week. And if they didn't get one next week, we were going to be in trouble. But I don't live that way anymore. Most people that are probably watching this aren't in that position where they have to worry about that. So you're choosing every day. You're choosing every week, every month, every year, what company you want to be a part of, what team you want to be a part of. And I think it's important to be strategic about that, whether you're the leader of the team and you're composing it, or whether you're on the team. Is this the right team for me to be on? Is the leader the right leader? Can I learn from them? Am I getting the growth that I need? And it doesn't mean you make knee-jerk reactions. It doesn't mean every day you're going to be happy. You know, sometimes, you know, you have to make sacrifices in the short term for the long term. But if you take a long-term view, you have to constantly be deciding, am I on the right team? When is it time to make a transition? When is it time to do something different for me to grow? And when is it time for me to just hunker down and help the team? Because that's also very important. And that's kind of what drives your day-to-day.
Yeah, picking the right team is so important. So I'm curious about, what's it like being on a board, and how did you know which boards to join, or how did you go about that process? And also, with being on the board of a newer company like Snapchat versus the board of a more established company like American Express, how have you seen kind of differences in culture or the way they're thinking about their business?
Yeah, I mean, look, the two boards I'm on are very different kinds of companies, and both very rewarding in their own way. You know, one very young, Snap, growing, new thinking, young leaders who've basically created a category and you know, done amazing things with Snap. One, American Express, that's an iconic company in our country, in our world, incredibly well-run, established, and you know, an important brand in our lives, and you know, very different. In some ways, I you know, wanted those different experiences because you know it allows me to help in different ways, and also teaches me you know, different things. And I would tell you, you know, being on a board is it's a different experience. It's something that is different than management, or it's different than working in a team. You're there more for as an advisor. You're there as, in some cases, as governance, to make sure that you're representing the interests of the shareholders, making sure that you're there to help make sure the leadership team is making good long-term decisions about the company itself. So as a board member, you're an advisor, you're a steward, you're there for governance. You're not there to run the company. I think those are important distinctions. And it's very rewarding. You know, one of the terms I use around being on a board is it's a service role. You know, I view myself as a board member. I'm there in service of others. I'm there in service of, you know, helping the leadership team make good calls, helping the, you know, making sure we're representing the interests of shareholders, making sure we're helping steward the company in the right way for the long term. And that's very different from running a company. It's very different from leading a company. And it's an important role, but it's usually one that you come to later in your career. It's usually one that is something that you do after you've had a chance to build some perspective on what those different elements of your role actually mean. You know, because you've run a company, because you've been faced with difficult choices, because you've had to think about the world in terms of how you lead and steward an organization over the long run. And you have to be comfortable that, you know, you're not there to run it. You're there to help it. You're there to guide it. And you're there to be part of it, but at a different level than the CEO or the leadership team that's operating the organization.
It's really insightful. And I think, Michael, you had a question also.
Sure. Yeah, I wanted to jump in with a quick question. By the way, I just noticed that I didn't realize that the chair of your Snap board is Michael Linton, my old boss from AOL.
Yes.
Give him my best.
I will definitely do that.
He's a character. On this sort of board, I mean, it's interesting having run a startup. I mean, a lot of our discussions with entrepreneurs, oftentimes that journey from sort of small company to large company, and you've done both. I'm sort of curious, now that you're sitting on large public boards, as you sort of think back to the founding of Cyvalence and other work, like, and as you probably engage with young entrepreneurs that are, you know, perhaps like raising their first capital and putting together early boards, like, what perspective do you have as a board member now of a large publicly traded company would you have for a small startup? I mean, are there sort of lessons learned that you sort of see kind of at the public company journey that you think are applicable for small company sort of boards and governance?
I'd say a couple of things. Number one, you know, obviously a board of a smaller company is very different. Now, the way I think about it is, you know, when you're a more mature company, things like governance, stewardship, those terms are more akin to, you know, strategy. Those are more akin to how you effectuate your role as a board member. When you're in a smaller company, your role as a board member is usually closer to, you know, the data, you know, so you're helping more, you're more guidance, you're more helping the leadership team build their company. You know, you might get a little bit more involved with, you know, particularly in private, you know, early stage companies. As a board member, you're likely going to be a lot more involved in what's going on in the company. You're probably going to be talking to customers. You're probably going to be helping recruit executives. You're going to be talking to the CEO a lot more frequently. And I think that's a little bit of a different role. So, you know, earlier stage board member, more active, a lot closer to what's going on in a day-to-day. Obviously, public company, billions of dollars. Your role as a board member is quite different. You're not as kind of interactive with what's happening on a day-to-day basis. But here's a couple of things that you can learn. Number one, it's never too early to set a proper foundation for the right governance of a company. So good hygiene around, you know, how you follow, you know, particularly if you're in an industry that might be regulated. You know, you might not be regulated when you're tiny, but if you're, for example, if you're a fintech startup, you're going to potentially be regulated as you grow. So it's never too early to start to think about, you know, what regulatory requirements might we have? Do we have good hygiene around my favorite topic, cybersecurity? Are we putting in the right foundations for that, because that's a foundation of trust? Do we have the right, do we follow the right standards? Those are things that I think are important to think about early on in the organization. Now, do we have good accounting practices? Do we have good, you know, sort of good practices around how we treat employees? Are we thinking about diversity early on? You know, don't wait till you're the size of Amex to worry about diversity. Diversity is important at the very beginning stages of any company. And so I give you those as some examples of areas where bigger companies spend a lot of time on this kind of stuff. Smaller companies don't always do it because they sort of say, well, my focus is I got to win this customer. I got to grow the business. I got to hire this person to do this particular job. And you're just kind of running so quickly. Sometimes you don't always think about the foundational elements of what's going to be required, particularly if you become a more successful business over the long run. Or frankly, if you're in a position to be acquired by a bigger business, they may be looking at you and saying, well, have you thought about this? Do you have these policies in place? Do you have these practices in place already? Otherwise, when they buy you, or if they buy you, they're going to have to come in and change a lot of that stuff for you. So it's never too early, again, with the right balance, because at the end of the day, if you're not in business, nothing else really matters. But with the right balance, putting in place some of the foundational elements of, you know, that I think are going to be very important for your company over the long run. It's good practice for any company of any size, no matter how early you are.
Great, thank you.
I think John had a question about board membership as well.
Oh, hey, yeah. I didn't expect to be put on the spot, but appreciate it. Yeah, hey, Chris. So you just going back to what you were saying earlier about board membership and the role of guiding and shaping the long-term vision for the organization. You know, it just occurs to me that there's a lot of thinking that is very based on quarterly results. And certainly, you know, the sprints of short-term growth, that kind of thing. How do you balance the two? Building for the long term, but needing to make a lot of decisions about, you know, oriented towards quarterly thinking. That was the thrust of my question. Thank you.
Well, as a board member, your job really isn't to manage the quarterly results. And I think, you know, in particularly in a large public company or a large cap company, if the board is involving themselves in the quarterly performance of the company, they're probably doing the wrong things. You know, the board is there for governance. The management team is there to manage the business. So they're there to operate the business quarterly, to make sure that the plans are being met, right? And that the expectations for the company are being met. The board is there to work with the management team to make sure that they're, you know, sort of setting the right objectives, meeting those objectives over a period of time. But as a board, it's really not your job to be managing quarterly results. I mean, you get the quarterly results like anybody else, like investors do. You know, you review performance versus expectations, performance versus targets. And obviously, in a company where the leadership team, let's say, is unable to consistently meet their objectives and their targets, then the board does have to consider, do we have the right leadership in place? And in many cases, it's really about the CEO. But you're not managing the day-to-day. You're there to really be part of making sure the longer-term objectives of the company are being met. And yes, if too many short-term objectives are being missed, that's when you got to put your shareholder hat on and say, do we have the right leaders to achieve the objectives of the company, short, medium, and long-term, on the organization's behalf?
Got you. Appreciate that. Thanks.
And if anyone has any other questions, feel free to put them in the chat. I can also read questions out loud if you don't feel comfortable going on video. So that's totally an option. But I guess we can kind of pivot the conversation to talk a bit about cybersecurity, because that's been a hot topic issue lately. And I guess thinking about like the recent Twitter hacks or even kind of the entire TikTok saga that's been going down. What are your thoughts about the future of corporate cybersecurity?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. Those two examples, I've separated those. They're very different, right? There's, you know, from a cybersecurity perspective, obviously every organization, this is public sector, private sector, even at a personal level, we all have to make sure that we're managing, you know, against attacks, you know, whether it's ransomware or sort of identity theft or data theft if you're a organization, or even disruption, frankly, of, you know, of your operations. And, you know, those are issues that every company is wrestling with, that governments are wrestling with. And that's, you know, that's why you're seeing, you know, a rise in spend on technology. There's in the cybersecurity industry over the last kind of 5 years or so, we've been scrambling to try to make sure that we could deal with what we call a talent shortage in the industry, just not enough trained cybersecurity professionals to take on all the jobs. In fact, it's hard to keep good cybersecurity professionals in a lot of organizations because they end up getting poached out by other companies at much higher salaries. So that's an ongoing challenge because, again, the importance of cyber continues to be on the rise at a relatively rapid pace. And, you know, so I would put the Twitter situation kind of in that category. Some employees got breached. That gave the attackers access to certain accounts that they shouldn't have had access to. And, the breach was identified, Twitter dealt with it. Not a good thing, but very, you know, what I would consider to be, you know, sort of that, those are the kinds of attacks that all organizations, companies, public sector, private sector, are all having to manage on a day-to-day basis. And those aren't going away anytime soon. In fact, with COVID-19, you know, we've seen ransomware attacks go on the rise. A lot of attackers are trying to use that as a guise, a Trojan horse, if you will, to, you know, get people to click on links and do such, do things that might compromise them or the organizations that they work for. The TikTok situation is a little bit different. You know, that that's kind of somewhere between a privacy concern at a very macro level, a data concern around U.S. citizens that are putting information about themselves into the app. And frankly, it's gotten caught up in a trade issue between the U.S. and China. And so that's a different category. And in fact, I don't even put the TikTok issues squarely in the camp of cybersecurity. I think privacy and personal data is an important element of kind of what cybersecurity professionals and tools and policies are meant to protect. But the TikTok issue, unfortunately, has got a lot of other dimensions to it that aren't necessarily about a cybersecurity challenge. I think there's a lot of issues going on between obviously our two, you know, the countries, China and the United States, you know, and the privacy element is an aspect of that. There's a trade element to that. You know, I do think that as an individual and even at a company level, it's important to take privacy very seriously. I do applaud, you know, some of the regulations that are attempting to make privacy a front and center issue, you know, like GDPR in Europe. You know, the specifics of legislation isn't always going to get things right, but the notion that our individual information, our privacy is very important, protecting the rights of individuals and their individual privacy is important. How we balance that with e-commerce, with the use of applications, with the desire of people to get their 15 seconds of fame on TikTok. Like those are all, though, you know, that's it's important that we have the privacy discussion, but be a little careful to say TikTok is a cybersecurity issue in and of itself, because that's not all that's going on there.
True, it is a very multi-layered issue. And I think Todd's hand was up for a question. And Ginger, thanks for your question. We'll get to that right after this one.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, Chris, you know, pre-COVID, there was a lot of pressure on the Bay Area, just high competition for talent, lots of costs. I think we see a lot of stories of people going to other parts of the country to start and grow their startups. And then post-COVID, there's a lot more momentum for that for obvious reasons. So are there things you think that Cleveland's entrepreneurial community can be doing to better position us to be more attractive to founders?
Yeah, it's a great point. I mean, I definitely see a move to more remote work happening out here. A lot of companies, as you guys can read about, are reassessing office space usage, reassessing density in the offices that they've got. And I do think that opens up opportunities for other areas. I mean, and the Bay Area has been struggling with this for a while. It's a great place to live. I love it. I love being in the Bay Area. I grew up in Cleveland, but it's an expensive place to live, and that's no secret to anyone. There's a lot of traffic, which can make lifestyle a challenge as well. You know, what my wife would tell you is if you guys could get global warming to sort of ramp itself up, Cleveland will become a little bit more attractive. You can't do anything about the snow. And I remember the snow in Cleveland. So that's going to be a hurdle. But I do think cost of living and educated and engaged workforce. So obviously Case Western is a huge part of this, you know, to the extent that, you know, people are coming out of undergrad and grad schools and interested and willing to stay in the Cleveland area and work for companies that might either set up operations there or even start themselves there. I think it's a real opportunity. And frankly, the remote nature of of work that I think is going to take real hold coming out of this, this COVID-19, you know, whenever we actually come out of it or whatever coming out of it looks like in the long run, I think it's going to open up opportunities. I do think it's going to clear at this point that companies are a little bit less oriented around density and kind of moving, getting a bunch of people in the same office. And so I think they're going to be willing to have people work from different places, be in different places. And if you're an individual, you know, there's a lot of things to love about the Cleveland area. It's not super dense. You don't have the same traffic issues as you do in a San Francisco or New York. You got educated people. I mean, there is a lot of infrastructure, and I think that's good over the long run for places like Cleveland to attract talent and to attract companies to want to make investments there.
Thank you.
Now we'll hop back over to Ginger's question. So she's asking, what advice do you have for a middle-aged woman who's wanting to make this career shift? Like, if you're in a current career that involves compliance with data security regulations as a component, but how could someone dive more deeper into the technical aspects?
Well, I think that if you're trying to make a career change and you're non-technical and you want more of a technical roles, you know, in many ways that's going to require education, maybe retraining in certain areas. Not impossible. I think there's a lot of ways to get educated around, you know, it might not turn you into a hotshot developer. You can definitely get more technically oriented. And there's going to be a lot of jobs that are not necessarily, again, hardcore development, but require enough technical facility that non-technical can train themselves and find opportunities in these places. So, you know, I think to some degree, it's about identifying what you want to do, making sure you've got the right training, and you're looking at you know where you can make the right entry points. You know, some companies have such a difficult time recruiting enough people. You know, they're willing to invest in training for certain roles in the organization. You know, one thing that I always find, you know, particularly in more technical companies, is one way in for people who are less technical is through places like customer service or customer support, where you can learn a lot about the products, you can learn a lot about the customers, but again, you might not have to have all the hardcore technical capabilities that you would if you were trying to go be in the engineering organization or the sales organization, where you have to be able to explain to a customer the details of the product. So, you know, that's just one area to think about, you know, as an entry point if you're in a non-technical organization, a non-technical job track, and you're looking to get into more of a technology-oriented company.
Thanks for those words of advice. As I said earlier, floor is still very much open for questions, but I'm kind of curious about your thoughts on hacktivism. What do you think about just that in general as a concept?
Yeah, I mean, you know, look, the interesting thing about what goes on in cyberspace is, if you look at it, so much of what we see in cyberspace mirrors what we do in a physical world. You know, there's activism in the physical sense. Makes sense to me that, you know, there will be activism, if you will, or hacktivism in cyberspace. You know, obviously, just like we see with what goes on in the physical world, you know, sometimes, you know, boundaries get crossed, lines get crossed, sort of trying to highlight certain issues, certain topic areas, advocate for certain issues or topic areas or set of society. But, you know, look, I expect that you know, we're going to continue to see people, hacktivists in this case, use online channels as a way to get their message out there. In many cases, it'll be, you know, on a positive level, but, you know, again, you know, hacking somebody else's website, as an example, is not the right way to bring, you know, sort of the right light to your cause or your issue. And so I think that, I don't support hacking anything that belongs to somebody else, But I'm, you know, but I also understand that, you know, what goes on online is going to mirror what we see in society. So I expect hacktivism is going to exist for quite a long time, and cybersecurity professionals will have to manage against it. And that's something that's just going to be a part of life. If you're a company, if you're a governmental organization, you're going to have to manage against that. Even universities, right? Universities probably deal with hacktivism quite a bit, and do because their students hack them every now and then to try to prove a point, try to highlight an issue, et cetera. And so universities are in some ways ground zero for this kind of activity. And again, their security departments have to be up to speed on what's going on, what the issues are, and in a position to protect the university property and the students and the faculty against attacks, whether they be hacktivists, nation states, or any of the above.
That's a great point on how, like, the lines between online and offline can really, you know, create these situations. But again, it is really about awareness and being aware of the best way to kind of handle them. And then we have a question from Tegan Horton, the founder at Founders Get Funds. This is a question from LinkedIn. So what do you think are the biggest challenges surrounding cybersecurity in the fintech industry?
You know, fintech and cyber, you know, in many ways is going to come down to trust. You know, how, you know, if you think about it this way, part of the value of the banking industry as it's known today is that it's built up trust over a long period of time. You know, there's you know, brands that have, you know, started out with physical locations and now offer a variety of different services. You know, there's been, you know, government regulation. And so, you know, we sort of writ large trust the banking system, and we trust banks, we trust financial institutions to be good stewards of our money and of our transactions. You know, what fintech organizations face is they're new, they're unknown, the transactions are different, they're faster, they're, you know, using devices and a bunch of different tools and technology that may or may not have been available even 3, 4, 5 years ago. What fintech organizations are going to all need to make sure that they keep front and center is, how do I build the right level of trust? Trust in the consumer, trust in the enterprise that I'm trying to be a part of, trust in the ecosystem that I'm trying to be a part of. And security is foundational building trust. If you've got good security, good visibility into what's happening, so you're either able to stop someone from, you know, sort of breaking into your systems, disrupting your transactions, or find and quickly deal with these attacks, that's going to be a hugely important element of the trust factor that
did he freeze for everyone?
Yeah, as a place to either put their money, facilitate transaction, et cetera.
Oh, Chris, we lost the last, starting from when you said trust factor, you cut out for a little bit. So if you could kind of just circle back on that answer really quickly.
So Sasong, I lost you there.
Okay, I'm going to wait. This is virtual life, right?
Yes. Right. That's what we did.
There we go. Let's try again. Sasong, so what did you miss from what I just said?
So you left off kind of talking about the value of trust, and you froze it down.
Okay. So in fintech, trust is...
Will we ever find out what is trust in fintech?
I don't know. It's like it unfreezes whenever you guys ask me a question.
Well, at least he's got a smile when he's frozen.
Oh, that's a good call out, Bob. Maybe we can try camera off.
Okay. Hey, Chris,
stopping video and see if that helps a little bit.
Okay. Great.
All right. How's the audio?
Yeah, that's good. The audio's good. Yeah, go ahead.
All right. So let's see. I might have a different. All right. That should be good. What I was saying is in fintech, and I think this is important, you got to build trust. you know, if you think about the financial services industry, banks, it's over literally hundreds of years, you know, operating over a long period of time. But fintechs are new. They're doing new things, breaking new ground, and they've got to build trust, trust in their transactions, trust in their security, because so much of our financial system, frankly, is based on trust. Cybersecurity is an important foundational element in building trust, in maintaining trust, you know, whether you can stop attacks from happening or actually mitigate the risk of an attack. You know, if you think about it as basic as this, right? You know, in even still happens today, but banks need to make sure that if they're getting robbed, if somebody robs a bank branch, you're not worried that your money's going away, that you're protected against that theft. And I think fintechs will have their modern day version of that. And cybersecurity, I think, is going to be an important element of their ability to build and maintain trust with their users, their ecosystem over the long term.
I think you're right. I think trust is so critical at this time. And as we're kind of wrapping up, so this is going to be kind of the last question here. But I'm curious, so as we navigate through this time, what's any words of advice you have about kind of how we can, I mean, in this period of, there's so much distrust of institutions and there's just kind of a lot of, I mean, to put it shortly, chaos going on. What are your words on how we can kind of find trust in each other during this time?
I think that we're in a period right now where, you know, frankly, you're right. There's a lot of breakdown in this country of trust, you know, in the government, in institutions. Obviously, COVID has taught us a lot about some of the weaknesses in our systems. And that's going to require a lot of rebuilding over time. It's going to require a rebuilding of the actual institutions and systems. It's going to be going to require a rebuild of trust. The way to do it, though, is you got to build. You got to get out there. We got to identify our problems. We have to make investments. You know, if there's anything I've learned over the last 6 months, it's that, you know, what's been highlighted for me is that, you know, we've allowed a lot of our basic institutions to be underinvested in this country. Healthcare, you know, just basic sort of, you know, welfare systems, the homeless problem, you know, we've kind of allowed, you know, sort of our state, you know, to function in a way that they haven't gotten the investments they've needed to deal with what we face today. And so my hope, and frankly, where I'm putting my emphasis as we look to elections in the fall and, you know, even in the near term, is investing and, you know, looking for people who are going to bring the right leadership to investing in the institutions that we need to protect people of, you know, all sort of walks of life, you know, all socioeconomic levels connected. And I think this has laid bare some of the challenges that we really face as a country. And it's true in all the states. And I think, you know, this is something that we're going to be wrestling with now for the next several years. It's not going to go away in 2020 or 2021. This is a long-term challenge and is going to require all of us, I think, to take a new look at how much we're all individually willing to invest in, you know, our fellow man and woman and their health and well-being, because we can't live in a society where every man for himself or every person for themselves. We've got to make sure we're taking care of everybody here, because we're not going to be a successful country over the long run for our children if we don't have the right systems, the right institutions, and the right investment in those institutions upon which we can build everything that we hold dear.
Thank you for that inspiring answer. And I think if you ever get bored with doing board work, you know, Chris Young 2020 could, or 2024, we move. But thanks again for all of your insight and for sharing your experience over the course of the past hour or so. So I'm just going to hand the floor back over to Michael to close this out.
Great. So thank you for moderating today. It's been awesome having you as a student, going to San Francisco with you, seeing you now out in the real world, Googling it. So every time I Google a term, I know that you're getting, 0.001 cents or something. So hopefully not selling my information. So, but it's great to see you and congrats on everything you've accomplished. And Chris, it's great to reconnect. It's we do look forward to having you back in Cleveland and on campus when the world gets back to travel and all those things. You can bring your family, and we're really proud of everything that you've accomplished. And it's fun watching the journey, and a lot of what you shared today, I think, is really helpful for our students and alums and other community members that are on here as we sort of think about, there's a lot going on in the world and as we move forward, and lots of great insights for kind of aspiring entrepreneurs and folks who want to get into cybersecurity. So thank you for taking the time to be with us today.
Happy to do it. Thank you all for having me. And sorry for the unstable internet connection here, but I think we got through most of it.
That worked out well.